This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR.
Listening to live and on-demand shows has never been easier on MPR. All you have to do is go to the App Store or Play Store on your device and search up Access Internet Radio NZ. Select and download the first option at the top of the list. Once you've downloaded the app, the next step is to open the app and look for MPR. Once found, select it and then browse freely. Supported by New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Colleen Crooks,
Barbara Bradbaugh,
and I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Colleen, you've just shown me your workshop that you use for your doll-making activities.
That's right.
Would you like to tell us something about that?
Absolutely, I would. I'm quite passionate about it. I've been making dolls for about 30 years, porcelain dolls. But prior to that, I was a bit of a doll collector. And prior to that, I was a war baby, so there were no dolls as such for my sisters and I to play with. So my mother actually made us cloth dolls, but I really wanted to have a porcelain doll.
So what's special about porcelain? Are they to play with or are they?
Well, to me, a porcelain doll was the ultimate in a baby. I had a wee friend down the road who had a porcelain baby doll, and I really, really wanted it.
So that's the complete doll, different parts that, that move?
Yep.
And then fully clothed? So you make the doll out of porcelain, and then you make the clothes?
But this doll that I really wanted, that my little friend had, was all porcelain with joints so it could move. Yeah. And, of course, the cloth dolls my mother made were just very much floppy cloth dolls, rag dolls, really. Okay. But we loved them because our mother made them for us, and anything that's mother made should be loved. Okay. But all my life I really wanted a porcelain doll.
So were these quite rare there? Very lucky children had them, did they?
Because what happened after the Great War, not very many doll makers existed in Germany and France and in England and America, because everybody went to war and, of course, they perished. And so the factories didn't start up, and so there weren't the dolls. And if there were dolls, they were too expensive for just little everyday children.
Are you saying that porcelain dolls used to be the norm before the First World War? Lots of children had porcelain dolls?
No, not lots. Only the very wealthy children. Very wealthy children. The poor children had dolls made out of socks and boots and bottles, whatever mother could find. Yeah. But the wealthy children, they were the ones with the porcelain dolls. But after the Great War, any German dolls were destroyed by the nannies because they didn't want anything German.
Were they the best dolls to get, the German ones then?
Well, that's debatable, because the French dolls were also very beautiful. Yeah. And the German dolls actually, though, had more character to them. They just put a lot more colour into the porcelain and made them look more childlike and lifelike. Whereas the French dolls, although they were very beautiful, they were very sort of stoic-looking dolls.
They're more for display than...
They came out for high tea and birthdays, and that's about all. But the German dolls were played with.
Yeah, you could actually play with them. Did they break easily if you dropped them?
They did indeed.
That would cause a bit of trauma.
And that's why I run also a little dolls hospital, and I repair a lot of dolls that have come to an unfortunate end. Not all of them because they've been dropped. Sometimes it was little brothers that tried to operate on these dolls and remove their tonsils and eyes and things like that.
You mean they're still getting fairly heavy use today? Because a lot of the children still get porcelain dolls to play with.
Well, they do, but they don't get the antiques, because the antiques are dolls that were made before, like the end of, say, 1909 was probably the last time they were making them in factories in Germany and France. After that, Well, it was the beginning of the plastic era really, and the celluloid era. Yeah. Celluloid came in the First World War for making aeroplane windshields and things like that, and then the scraps on the floor were made to use for celluloid dolls, which were highly inflammable. A lot of children got burnt because they put them next to the fire. And in thunderstorms, they chewed the celluloid fingers, and they ended up with tummy aches. So, it wasn't always a lovely thing to give a child a celluloid doll.
What would be more dangerous, the celluloid dolls or the lead soldiers?
Oh, that's right, the lead soldiers. It was a pretty brutal world for children in those days. Anyway, after that, the plastics came in, and vinyls and things like that. And so if we wanted to reproduce an antique, which most people can't afford a really good antique, they can reproduce them in my studio, the same doll, but with today's trend on it.
So I saw you had a lot of moulds there. Uh-huh. So you can get standard moulds
for
the different...
I have to send overseas for them, and I can get an antique mould reproduction of just about any doll, and they can make the doll in my studio and dress it and learn all about the history of the maker, the original maker of that doll. Okay. The history is actually the most important, not most important, but the thing I love the most about the doll industry. Who made the dolls? Why did they make them?
Okay.
It's really interesting. And then after that, it's learning the chemistry of the different paints and the different firings of the kiln. There's an awful lot to it.
Now, so we've got there's a mould.
Uh-huh.
These are porcelain dolls.
Uh-huh.
So what's the mould made out of?
The mould is made out of plaster of Paris and potter's clay. There's a few little composites in it.
Okay. And then you've got two parts and you've put it
together. Sometimes there's three or four parts to a mould if it's quite intricate. And then into that we pour a slip that also comes from America. It's a porcelain slip. And the porcelain is a liquid.
A slip is basically the porcelain in water.
Yeah. Okay. Now the clay that's in the water, the porcelain clay, is made up of three or four components, one of them being a potter's clay of some sort. Mm. One of them is guano. Now, guano is a bird dropping that comes...
Oh, like guano, is it?
Yeah,
is
guano. Guano, depends
on
what part of the island you come from.
Yes.
Guano. And it comes
from caves where all the bats nest.
But this particular porcelain... But the guano that we use comes from a bird that eats a certain leaf and goes to a certain island. So it's
so special. And why is that? That affects the way the porcelain comes. Now, you're saying porcelain. What's the difference between porcelain and other clays? You say you get clay.
Well, it's much finer. It's much finer, and it's.
Is it translucent?
More like a can china.
It can be translucent.
A bit like bone china? Yeah, is that something different?
Yeah, very close. Different factories do different refining.
Okay.
And so they can take out all the bits they don't want and put in the bits they do want. So you get a bit of silicon and things like that, and that'll give it a different sort of finish.
Yeah.
So we get it from there, from America, and we pour it into the mould.
Now, is it a very thick layer when it...
It's liquid.
Very thin. It's liquid when it goes in, but when it's fired, is it a thick porcelain? They're quite solid.
Uh-huh. Yeah. When you open the mould and take it out of the mould, it's brittle. It's like an eggshell, and if you squeeze it, it'll explode, it'll break.
Okay.
Uh-huh. But you still have to be able to work it and to clean it, to put it in the kiln, to bring it to bisque. And when it's bisque, It's like biscuit, bisque, meaning biscuit.
Like biscuit, yeah. So you've got the, first you've got the, it's a slip which dries to a, now I can't remember the term
greenware.
For the clay.
Greenware.
Yeah. Yeah. Then you do a first firing so it comes out as bisque or biscuitware.
Yes, yes, that's right.
Which can be brittle, but you can...
At this stage it's not brittle. You can...
After it's been fired once,
You can handle it quite nicely. And then you start painting it.
Now, when you say paint, it's not a normal paint, is it?
No. Okay. It's China paint. Now, the early China paints had a lot of lead in it, huge amount of lead to give it that nice sort of glow. But over the years, and we've become much wiser health-wise, we realised that we shouldn't be using so much lead, especially for someone like me that's inhaling it every day. And so they've been able to keep the lead content down, but they've been able to keep the nice glow we want by adding a flux which is lead free, which is
a sort of metal addition.
It's another powdered form of China paint. Is all it is ground glass that is coloured.
Okay.
And it melts with the heat of the kiln impregnates.
Oh, hence a glaze. Yeah. Bigger glaze is a glass. You're putting a thin glass layer on.
Sure, and that's what happens. If you could look into the kiln, but you can't because of the heat, you would see the tiny fragments melting into the porcelain. So it's there. It's not a transfer. That paint is there forever and ever and ever. It's there.
Because when you fire it with the glaze on, you're firing it at a higher temperature than the bisque.
Oh, no.
The same temperature
lower temperature. Yeah, this is where it's different from pottery.
Yes, okay,
so we fire to bisque at about 1200. Roundabout, every kiln's a wee bit different.
That's quite high.
Mm. But with the China paints, depending on the colours, reds and purples are a bit different. Probably about 780. Most kilns would fire a good glaze at that.
Because you're not going to be sort of eating off it or anything. With pottery, you'd use a higher glaze. A high firing would be the glaze
and
firing.
Yes, because it's tableware. But ours are dollies or ornaments and things like that.
Would the end result be waterproof, so you could do a vase like that?
Oh, yeah, we do vases. Barbara's made some lovely vases, haven't you?
I need to get a file of the paint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a bit of greenware, if you can see in it. Okay,
so you do all the fire, and you fire all the little bits and pieces now. Okay, so you can do, say, the arms and legs, they're enclosed. Mm. How do you have a mould for something like you have it in different bits that you then seal together, or...?
The mould, if you can picture it, is empty. It's an empty vessel.
Yes.
So when you pour, after a few minutes, when you've poured the slip in, then you pour it out.
Yeah.
And so that empty vessel is still empty. It's only the sides
just
that are...
Just around the outside. Yeah. Yes. Okay, yep.
You got me?
So you put the slip in and you let some of it sort of set and then you pour out the excess.
That's right.
Okay. Yep.
That's bisque.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And I've just got... Okay, thanks, Barbara. There's a shoe that's bisque fired, but it's not just a shoe, but it's a Christmas decoration, is it? Is that a mouse in
a
shoe?
A wee mouse, yeah.
And the amount of detail in there is really quite amazing. So, yes, and even there's a piece coming out of the top with a hole, so you could put some string through and hang it off a Christmas tree.
That's the idea.
So it all comes in one piece just from one mould.
That's from one mould, And that's China paint.
And here's some... I've got a small container of China paint, which just looks like a bit of very fine green-coloured gravel. Yeah. Okay.
I grind that up with a medium, sort of a glycerine-type medium.
Glycerine-type medium.
an oil, really. Well, it's not. Yeah, it's glycerin.
Vaseline.
No, glycerin.
Glycerin.
Yeah. So I wipe. I grind that up with a palette knife on a tile and to a toothpaste consistency. If you like, and and then we start painting. Now it is quite intricate, but it's something that once the ladies start, they want to perfect.
Yeah, because something like this, I can see where it's about 5 centimeters high, and you've got all the different parts in there, the mouse's scarf and the buttons on the shoe and so on. And you do each of those in different colours, would you? So it could be could be very ornate. And with the firing, it actually stays exactly where it is.
It does.
Okay.
Yeah. So, as you can imagine, you can't paint the whole thing in one go, and that could take up to 5 different paintings before they've finished.
So you do what? So a different colour each time, or different?
They might start off painting the face, the eyes, and that, and then they'll come back and do a little bit more every class.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's what they do in class. They do a little bit. They have 7 or 8 projects going at once and do a little bit.
Now, if you're doing pots in a kiln, you can't put the glaze on the parts where it's going to stand in the kiln, because then it would just the glaze would seal it to the
that
tray.
Can happen.
Now, with these, it won't just stand on its own, will it? So
no.
How do you manage?
Well, there's a wire that a prop, if you like, that you can use, and it's highly, I don't know the proper word for it, but it's a wire that you can put in the kiln and it won't burn.
Something that can take high temperatures and so on. So it's a sort of almost like a stand with wires sticking up, and you just put them on there.
Because the same
a wire rack.
Same thing would happen with that
if
student had glazed the bottom of that, and I put it on the floor of the kiln, it could possibly adhere to it. But I do use a firing sand on the bottom of the kiln to stop that.
So it would just pick up a bit of the sand.
And I could just sand it off.
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of little tricks you learn as you go with firing. And if I've got a kiln full of the students' work, I can hardly wait to open it the next day to see if everything's turned out the way they
want. Absolutely, because you never quite know, do you? Are the colours always true?
Not always.
Because they change a lot.
I mostly know what colour that's going to be, apart from the reds and purples.
Why is that? Because the paint doesn't look the same before and after firing?
I think they're the most expensive paints to buy, and they do actually contain gold, reds and purples, and I think they fire differently. If I put an article that's been painted with a lot of red on it, it'll only take so much firing before the red starts to burn and it goes dull. So you sort of have to measure what you're going to put in the kiln this time and the next time. But it's great. I love it. I've had very few disappointments, really.
How much is a file like that a paint?
How much? You're about 2.5 centimetres high and about a centimetre wide, a small round tube, basically.
Well, it depends, once again, on the colour. If that was a red, it would be about $16, $18. But a bland colour could only be about $6.
Yeah, this is green. How far would it go, then?
Well, how long's a piece of string?
Well, do you use a lot in painting? Do you need a thick layer?
At Christmas time, I probably mostly use greens and reds because people are making Christmas decorations. And so a file, I could go through a file in one class, but other colours I might have for 5 years and not use as much.
Now, you've used the word a few times, the class.
Yeah.
So you teach this, or how does it work?
I have several classes a week. I have a class on Monday that about half a dozen ladies come to, and they paint all different things, dollies and Christmas decorations and ornaments. And then on a Wednesday morning, I for some years have been teaching a young woman who was badly injured in a motor vehicle accident. And I actually nursed her initially, and she still comes and makes dolls, and she's great. And Wednesday afternoon I have a very busy class, and Thursday night I have a class. On the school holidays, okay, I have had several children's classes, school children's classes, because I'm very keen in fostering this hobby, and to teach young children how to thread a needle and do some basic little sewing stitches.
Okay. So with the classes, are they making the pottery? Are they just glazing, biscuit pottery? And then you talk about needles and clothes.
I don't teach the adults any sewing, because I think they should know. Can I have a drink of water? But the children, I do. They get this. I do the first part.
Yeah, a biscuit piece, yes.
Yeah, they get that. Unless they are quite skillful, I'll let them clean it themselves.
Okay, yeah.
In fact, for competition work, if they want to enter a competition, they have to do the whole thing from start to finish.
Okay.
I'm not supposed to.
Yeah. Okay.
I can oversee it, but I don't pick up a paintbrush or I just guide them.
So there are competitions for school children, you mean, or for adults, for everybody?
Everybody.
So there's a big organisation here then, isn't there? Okay.
It was bigger. I mean, was there somebody there? Can you go and see who's there? When I first started at... I had about 100 odd members in our club, and now we're down to about 10. Because, like anything, age catches up.
Yeah. And is it mainly older people who get interested?
Yes. So, but that's why I'm fostering the children. When a student wants to enter a doll into a competition, the first thing I say to her is that good on you, because you've got to really have good skills, but you must research what you want to do. You just don't paint a doll and hope for the best, because there's a lot of intricate work goes into doing everything perfect.
Well, you're trying to follow the traditional style for the dolls?
I'm talking traditional at the moment. And modern dolls, you can pretty much please yourself. But if we're following the antique, the master doll maker, we have to really study it very carefully and see what colours and what strokes he used, etc. And then the dressing is very intricate. Yeah.
So in the competition, they're judged on how authentic they are.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. The first thing the judge looks at is how close did you get to the original.
So how big is this in New Zealand and in Palmerston North?
Well, I tell you what, doll making and collecting is the second biggest hobby in the United States of America after stamp collecting.
Okay.
It's huge, and it's huge in other countries in the world. In Japan and America, the continent.
And in New Zealand?
In New Zealand, it's having a bit of a downturn. It was huge about 20 years ago, and other crafts seem to take over. There's lots of other crafts around, and they're all lovely. When our club in the heyday, we were over 100 people, and as I say, we're now down to about 10.
And in the heyday, how long has the club been going?
33 years, I think. Yeah. 33.
And the heyday was early on in that?
Yeah. Probably, I would say, we started off having shows, doll shows, doll and teddy bear shows at the racecourse, and it was huge.
Doll and teddy bear, so they're parallel interests? Well, different groups do.
Different groups, different, really. Okay. Really, pretty
yeah.
much.
Yeah.
And teddy bears were a huge hobby at one stage, but they've actually slipped down even further than dollies. So for the competition, it was usually a national competition. People from all over New Zealand would come and Australia. And we would get 400 or 500 dolls in a competition. Now we sort of struggle to get 40, really, in a competition.
Okay.
But the standard is just as high. I mean, our standards haven't slipped.
Is that the people who carried on for a long time and just build up their expertise?
And their skills. And in everything today, you have to study.
Yeah.
Okay. And Barbara, who's with us today, has studied really hard. You can sit exams. You do an apprenticeship.
Okay.
Which takes 3 or 4 years.
A formal apprenticeship,
which we have done, Barbara and I have done. And at the end of that, you go to an international competition in Australia or America. But we went to Australia. And we got our master's in doll making, which is a bona fide degree. Yeah. Well, not, in America, it's a bona fide. I don't think it is in New Zealand. But
equivalent to a master university master's degree.
It is for the study we do. You've got
You've done three or four years full time study.
Learning every single thing there is, every mark on every doll. And then after that, you can go on and do your Triple Crown, which Barbara went on to do. And after that, you can do a doctorate. You do a thesis. And the thesis usually involves visiting factories, porcelain factories in Germany and on the continent, and actually doing hands-on work.
So there's still a lot of production.
Oh, sure. Well, not a lot. Okay. You see, the porcelain factories in Germany and in Sonnenberg and in France, they were mostly, I'd say, in the 1850s, 1860s, up to about 1890, were making tableware, ornaments, and dinner sets, and beautiful, you know, Limoges and all those beautiful Dalton figures and things. And with the sweepings off the floor, they sort of made a few little dollies. And then they realised they were getting more money for the dollies than they were for their tableware.
Okay.
So these beautiful factories started making huge production lines of dollies, and hundreds of people were employed.
And this is when?
This is about 1880 to 1910, 1912.
Okay, in that period.
And it was
You're saying now they go over, if you're doing a doctorate, they go into these factories.
Yes, because they're still in production. A lot of them were bombed during the war, but this factory is still producing porcelain tableware and dinnerware. But not so many dolls come out.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
Support this program and others like it by giving a donation to NPR. More details at npr.nz.